Well, as we discussed earlier, another country that has won praise for their response is Taiwan. An article in The Conversation described it as exemplary. As of the end of June, Taiwan, the population of around 24 million, had recorded just 7 deaths linked to the virus, with 447 confirmed cases. With us is a New Zealander who resides in Taiwan, Bernie Moore. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Wallace.
So tell me, what is the current status of COVID-19 now? Is it under control there?
It pretty much is. It's similar, very similar to New Zealand right now. There are no locally transmitted cases and nothing for the last 3 months. With the last fatality being about 2 months ago, of the last one being 7th.
In a nutshell, Bernie, what was Taiwan's secret? How do they do it?
Well, if you get some background, the fact is that there are a lot of cultural ties between both China and Taiwan. So business, economic, social ties. So there's a lot of thousands of people traveling between both countries. And Taiwan learned from the SARS problem 2003, where they were poorly prepared back then when the situation happened, and they probably had the most adverse results from being poorly prepared. So since 2003, they've had a very good system set up to prevent future happenings. So they were aware mid-December of the situation developing in Wuhan. So by late December, they started screening passengers arriving from China.
That early?
That early. And they've followed on from there, from doing things from screening passengers arriving to actually closing the borders pretty quickly once things started picking up.
What measures were taken? Did Taiwan ever go into lockdown?
No, Taiwan actually never did a lockdown. The part of the measures that they did was actually making sure people wore masks in public situations, going to malls, movie theatres, hospitals, and public transportation as well. So lots of people wore masks. Actually, everybody had to, under threat of getting a fine of some sort. So there were a lot of mask wearing, people going to schools, had temperature checks and stuff like that. So everyone was highly aware of the situation and they followed the rules as best they could.
And in terms of the economy, because, you know, New Zealand, of course, has been pretty successful as well, but we have taken quite a hit to, you know, businesses. Some are suffering. What of Taiwan?
Taiwan generally has not had a lockdown, but of course the travel between two countries has restricted a lot of business, and a lot of Taiwanese people actually work in China. So economically, it hasn't been too bad, comparatively, I suppose, speaking, when you talk about New Zealand and China, Taiwan. But the economy has kept going, and so actually there hasn't been that much stress on the economy.
No. In terms of technology, how was tech deployed in helping beat the virus? I believe, for example, mobile phone tracking was quite the thing.
Yes. So if you actually did get exposed to the virus, you probably would have had to go into a lockdown situation at a hotel of some sort. And you would have been monitored with through your cell phone, where you were going, what you were doing. So the government was quite aware of what was going on with you if you had your cell phone with you. I think people were quite happy with that situation. I don't think there was anybody too concerned that it would be infringing their rights.
Just finally, Bernie, one thing that was noted in an article I was reading, that amidst all the praise that New Zealand is getting, I can't help feel that Taiwan was getting overlooked internationally. What are your thoughts?
Yes, Taiwan actually was a bit overlooked, because actually in mid-December they were actually informing the proper authorities that there was something happening, and it took a long time for that message to make it down the line. And Taiwan was already taking steps to prevent it happening within their borders long before it was actually recognised worldwide. They had a bit of an issue getting the message up the line to the UN and the WHO, which took too long, I think. So it was a bit... I'm sure if they'd listened to Taiwan, the situation wouldn't be as serious as it is now worldwide.
Yeah. Very interesting. Nice to have you on. Bernie Moore, who's lived in Taiwan for 18 years. Go well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Wallace.
Isn't that interesting? Started enacting the issue in December, which is really quite something, Catherine.
Oh, I know.
And before Christmas, yeah.
Well, I mean, it just, you know, it's another indication that swift and decisive and comprehensive action has, you know, got good results. But I didn't realise that they had been trying to sound the warning and had been ignored, which is horrifying. For whatever reason, but what are they doing about their citizens coming in? Are they doing much the same as we're doing with a quarantine?
Yes, I believe they are, and they are also slowly starting to open their borders. I think cruise ships, there's a relationship there starting, as was reported this week, I think, Phil.
Yep.
There's one to watch. Have you been to Taiwan, Phil?
I have. Or it's Catherine? A wonderful place, Taiwan. But it's an island, of course, which helps. But so it's plausible they could do this. But I thought there was a great interview with Bernie. I thought the most insightful thing he said out of all the insightful things he said was they had learnt from SARS. See, we put our pandemic response based on the Spanish flu of 1918-1919, and these other pandemics have gone through, and so the Asian economies had learnt, and you see this going through Asian airports. They'll have all the temperature monitors and stuff that all came through the SARS crisis, and they use technology a lot because Taiwan's an incredibly technology-centred sort of a place. And, of course, they've also got a society that's not a million miles dissimilar to New Zealand, and it's very dissimilar, of course, but it has this similarity in the sense that we're likely to follow the rules. We're a settled society. If our politicians say you should do a thing, then we'll generally do it. And so they use all of that technology. But the critical thing, I think, that we can learn from Taiwan is how they didn't do a hard lockdown, and now they're opening their border because they trust the technology and they trust their contact tracing. And that's key. And we don't. And I think that's something we can learn from Taiwan.
We've let contact tracing kind of slip, haven't we?
Precisely.
Yeah.
And we've been on this little lifeboat in the Pacific, and it's a pretty... I don't know if you've ever been on a lifeboat before, but they're dark and damp and dangerous and most uncomfortable.
Have you been on one?
I watched the Titanic.
Yeah, okay. Another interesting point that the article in The Conversation made, this was actually one thing that was recommended to New Zealand to do better... Taiwan adopted what was known as a cooperative strategy. There was great communication across departments. So it activated this thing called the Central Epidemic Control Command Centre, the Central Epidemic Command Centre, the CECC, to coordinate cooperation across government ministries and agencies and between government and businesses. It was quite extraordinary, the level of cooperation, Phil, and something that we could learn perhaps too.
Precisely, and it doesn't surprise me that Taiwan would do that because that's the nature of Taiwan. It's a very, very disciplined society, and they have a real view about Taiwan's success that's a shared view and a common view. So we didn't see that in New Zealand either. We saw a whole bunch of government officials simply go home. Now, it's not their fault, but they did. And we saw businesses really often being left in the dark about what was going on, and still are. The point about the border opening, businesses, you know, with the Sarah Trotman piece, Sarah Trotman earlier on, saying if businesses could understand what the planning looks like, they could actually make some plans themselves. So all of that's quite lacking, I think, in New Zealand. And we've had a kind of a big government response, which worked, which is great. But now we need much more cooperation about how we're going to move forward. And that's really not happening right now.
But quite a bit of response, actually, about Taiwan. I'll just read a couple because they are interesting. Colin says, I spent a month in Taiwan last year and I would love to go back. Bring on the Taiwan-New Zealand bubble.
Yep.
Okay, so why not if they that's successful? Another one here. Wallace, you will find that Taiwan has a prime minister or vice president who is an epidemiologist who sent a team to check on the situation in Wuhan very early in December. But another one here, Peter says, this is Peter's thoughts. Taiwan, the question is why we did not learn from them and set up a pandemic plan. The reason is that we in the Western world were complacent, arrogant and racist. We knew better. We were immune because we are more clever than them and have nothing to learn from countries outside the Western world.
Some truth to that.
So that is a viewpoint from Peter. Thank you for your thoughts this afternoon. You can text us 2101 or email the panel at rnz.co.nz. With me this afternoon, we have novelist Catherine Robinson and business leader Phil O'Reilly. To this, social media giants are not cooperating with China's new security laws being imposed on Hong Kong. Critics of the new laws say the measure, which criminalises secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion with foreign forces, devastates Hong Kong's autonomy. Now social media giant TikTok has announced it will exit the Hong Kong market, and other technology companies are also suspending processing government requests for user data in the region. The developments come as no surprise to Jack Yan, originally from Hong Kong, now living in Wellington. Jack, welcome to the panel.
Yeah, kia ora. Maybe hamana kia koto kato, kia ora.
Wonderful to have you on, Jack.
Yeah, lovely to be back on the panel. we've noticed a few things actually happening in Hong Kong too, the effects of this new law. I mean, we've got a whole democracy movement that's shut down. Demisisto, which is Joshua Wong, he's decided to quit. We've got journalists self-censoring because they're so worried of what they're writing will get them in trouble with. Those four things that you've just read out. And what's also quite worrying is that those four crimes, you can go to prison for life if you do them, and they're not really defined in the Act. So I'm tending toward these tech companies. I hear what they're saying. A lot of them have paused their actions pending review of this new law.
I just want to ask you first, Jack, on a personal note. When you see a home country, a place that you've lived, born, grown up in and loved, and you see this happening, what goes through your mind?
Well, it's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, one reason we came to New Zealand in the 70s was this. My parents foresaw that a bit early. They thought by 1997 this would actually all be kicking off. And, when you look at television from Hong Kong, you do feel a bit of homesickness. Even though I left as a boy, but I do still feel a little bit of a connection to the place, and it is heartbreaking. And the other heartbreaking thing is, China had all the opportunity to make this work. One country, two systems actually isn't such a bad idea, and in the long term, maybe even Chinese Commonwealth isn't a bad idea either. That would encourage people to be part of it. But right now, what they're doing is stoking fear, and so I worry about the people back there, and I worry about the sort of lives they may lead under this administration.
Well, in terms of the lives, one Joshua Rosenzweig, who is the head of Amnesty International's China team, he pulled no punches in saying the passing of the national security law is a painful moment for the people of Hong Kong and represents the greatest threat to human rights in the city's recent history. What are your thoughts?
Well, he's not exaggerating at all. For example, there's no presumption of bail. So you think, OK, well, I might get charged in this, but, hey, at least there's an independent judiciary in Hong Kong. Well, according to the Act, there is no independent judiciary. The judges are appointed by the chief executive, Carrie Lam, herself. So, and we know that she's pro-Beijing. She's so unpopular there at the moment. She makes Trump look like Obama. And there's no limit on how long you can be held if you're charged under the crime. In fact, the first man charged under it, he has been denied bail. He's deemed a flight risk, even though presently he's in a wheelchair because of his injuries. So if he's a flight risk, then pretty much everyone else is. The other point that Joshua makes, again, why I agree with him, is Article 38 says this applies outside Hong Kong. So you and I, Wallace, we could be saying something that could be deemed a crime of subversion and we could be charged under it. Now, obviously, New Zealand wouldn't allow us to be deported, but they could well find us guilty. They really have the balls to try to make this apply to everyone on the planet.
Quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, how will this change the day-to-day lives? If you just keep on going, living your life, I mean, it's got that, it's got the traditions, it's got great cultural traditions. The art, contemporary art out of Hong Kong right now is off the hook. They've had civil liberties not enjoyed across the border. How do you think this will change? Will it have a chilling effect? Will life change that much? What do you reckon?
Majority of people who might be thinking right now, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, I just want to get off my life.
Right.
But I still generally believe people felt a bit freer in the past. You might say, well, the British didn't give Hong Kong democracy either, and that's a fact too. But the people felt free, I think, to express themselves. I mean, the one thing the first person charged in the act has said, he used the slogan which said, "Liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times," which is the sort of thing that probably you could say quite easily 20 years ago, and no one would really think twice about it. They just think, okay, well, you know, you're pro-independence, good on you. Whereas now, I think there'll be people thinking twice. There'll be a lot of young people who'd be, I think, really looking at perhaps residing elsewhere, or perhaps just, yeah, trying to button down and change the way they act and change the way they behave just to conform. So I'm not sure if the freedoms are going to be there. I think that this really will change the way Hong Kong is and will be.
While you're there, let's jump with it. Let's get our panellists jumping in. I don't know if you've had anything to do with Hong Kong, Catherine, or if you've been there. It's a place I've always wanted to go. But it's certainly pretty severe what's happening.
Oh, it's appalling. And I think, I mean, I'm amazed. Jack sounds so sort of, I mean, he's very clear about it, but you sound so relaxed about it. And I'm sort of going, I don't know, you're probably not relaxed, but I'm just, this is an absolute violation of human rights. And I think the most terrifying thing that you said was there's no definition of those terms under the Act. So, I mean, you could be wearing a T-shirt with something that somebody finds a bit off and you're in. No bail. You're imprisoned for life. It's horrifying. And the fact that, you know, people I know that are from Hong Kong living here talking about, well, are they really protected? I mean, yes, our country would obviously not let us be deported, but who else would suffer, you know, relations, etc. I just find the whole thing absolutely terrifying.
Phil?
Well, I've been to Hong Kong on several occasions. It's one of the most extraordinary parts of the world. It's so vibrant and full of life and full of innovation, and, you know, sometimes can feel pretty edgy, actually. And the sad thing about what's going on is that will start to go away. And I thought the UK did a clever thing the other day by saying, look, if you're a Hong Kong citizen, you can come to the UK. And what will happen is the best and brightest will. And those clever technology companies will leave, because they're not going to be under the yoke of the Chinese wanting all the details and the data about what they do. They're not in China anyway at the moment. They'll just leave there as well. So the competitiveness and this creativity that the globe can get from Hong Kong will simply go away. And that's a very, very sad thing, not just for Hong Kong and China. It's a sad thing for the rest of us.
But what if like, leaving the country was seen as an act of subversion?
Probably will be, but they won't be back. That's my point. I mean, that's what happened over the course of history.
I know.
The brilliant people leave dictatorships and travel to democracies.
I'm worried about them being not able to leave.
Jack, sure. Before we leave, are you still there, Jack? Can I just one more question? I just want to ask you, this was always going to happen. It's just brought a bit early.
Yeah, I mean, my parents thought it happened in 97. I thought it might have been 2047 when the Joint Declaration basically runs out, the one the British and the Chinese signed. The interesting thing, though, Phil, you brought up the UK. I think, first of all, we've got to ask whether Boris Johnson can be both Prime Minister and the father of a newborn child. But the second thing is, I don't think currently what they're proposing is that different. You've still actually got to apply. It's not automatic. You've still got to pay £600 a year for your health surcharge. So in my book, it's about as different as the old Austin 1300 Mark III and the old Austin 1300 Mark II. Yeah, the British are great at making speeches about stuff. Tony Blair was making speeches about this when he was in opposition. And I think all the British have really been able to do is have Chris Patten write a few editorials. So, I mean, I'd like to see BNO. I'm a BNO passport holder, British National Overseas Passport holder. I'll believe when I see it. But I do agree with you generally, Phil. I mean, there could be a brain drain.
Just a question, because a bit of interest in this. Wallace, can you ask your guest what's in this for China if they, while quote-unquote out of Hong Kong as a finance centre, what does the Communist Party get out of it?
Well, they, I think they have been quite happy to let the other major Chinese cities, Shenzhen, Shanghai and so forth, be the big financial hubs. So in many ways, Hong Kong has become more and more sacrificial in their eyes. I mean, it's no longer a manufacturing hub. It is, I suppose, a gateway between East and West. But if certain countries carry out their threats, you know, such as the US, then what special status does Hong Kong have after that? People might just deal with Shanghai if they want to deal with the Chinese economy. So they may just centralise their power within the mainland.
All right, Jack Yan, appreciate you being on the program. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
That's very interesting, Phil, that sort of shift, that business shift from Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's right. It's been going on for some time, as a matter of fact.
Oh, has it?
Yeah, so the Chinese have been investing it. Jack's absolutely right about that. They've been investing in places like Shenzhen, just a massive city now across the border, of course, and also in Shanghai as the financial capital. And, of course, for them, that's about control, because they don't quite control Hong Kong. So then they're suspicious of that, of course, and so they want control. And they've got the wherewithal to do that. So that's why they're building new financial centres and new business centres elsewhere on the mainland.
Just finally, someone asked if there was a bubble that opened up with New Zealand, where is the first place you'd like to go? Around the panel, Catherine.
Ooh, I want to go to Iceland. I've never been. I've always wanted to go.
Yeah, totally. Because they do well at Eurovision.
They do. That's the reason, eh? The first thing. I was sitting and thinking of one of those volcanic hotspots, sure. You know. That'd be great.
I'd go to Sydney because a lot of my family are there and a lot of my friends. So I know that's a boring call, but I'd probably go there, I must say.
Are you hoping that we can do that soon?
I'm forever hoping. I mean, this goes to creativity. I mean, I'd love to be able to open a bubble to New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia, West Australia, Northern Territory. But, of course, the Australian government's not going to allow that.
Victoria,
that's right. Aww. Because, actually, the rest of these states really don't have the same problem that Victoria does. Now, that's not going to happen because Prime Minister Morrison said that he's only going to open Australia, not the states. Well, fair enough. That's the way things goes. But I'm not particularly hopeful there'll be a border opening to Australia this time of Christmas, frankly. I think that's quite a long way away.
When do you expect?
Oh, I'd say around Christmas time. I mean, there's talk about summer tourism. Maybe that's summer, isn't it? Sort of December time. So I think it's about then that we'll always use
Christmas as a, it'll be over by Christmas, or it'll be open by Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's
and of course
so.
The election's gone by then, so the politics is a little less fierce at this side of the Tasman.
Ugh.
Are both of you looking across? I mean, particularly in light, going back to the start of the show, what happened today when? You know, the countdown in the centre of the city has shut down. People had to go home to self-isolate. Are you concerned that what might happen in Melbourne might happen here?
It's always a challenge, of course, but it goes back to our trust and use of technology, contact tracing and so on. That's the way to minimise that risk. But of course it's a risk. Could happen, sure.
Mm. I think it just shows that it can happen anywhere, and we've just got to play it safe.
Yep. Catherine Robinson, Phil O'Reilly, you've been wonderful. Thank you very much for your time.